Hello, and welcome to my podcast called Adventures on the Can-Do. I am your host, Jothy Rosenberg, a.k.a. The Incorrigible Entrepreneur. A professor turned entrepreneur and founder of 9 companies, on this show, I talk with business leaders and personal achievers. Adventures on the Can-Do explores the challenges and rewards of entrepreneurship, overcoming adversity, and where grit and perseverance can get you. Be inspired by others and push yourself along your path to success and fulfillment. Before we jump into today's episode, just a reminder of how you can support this podcast. You can go to my website, jothyrosenberg.com, and sign up for my newsletter. And there you can also see other episodes of this podcast. Also, please follow us on one of the many social media channels we post on. And with all that behind us, let me introduce you to our guest on today's episode, Steve McCarthy. Steve is an Emmy Award-winning network TV news producer and documentary filmmaker. And he formed McCarthy Productions, Inc. in 2001 and produced projects for 60 Minutes, Dateline, Charlie Rose, MSNBC, PBS, BBC America, Reuters, and others. In 2006, he directed an independent documentary film, Finding Patty, a documentary about 9/11, which aired in more than 20 countries. In 2016, he co-produced the documentary, The One That Got Away, which aired on PBS. In 2019, he co-directed and co-produced an HBO documentary about journalism through the life stories of Pete Hamill and Jimmy Breslin called Breslin and Hamill, Deadline Artists. It was the winner of the 2019 National Emmy. In 2019, he also co-produced the documentary feature Life with Layla about a New Jersey family caught in the grips of the opioid epidemic. In 2022, he directed and co-produced Eva's Promise about a Holocaust survivor's promise to her brother to share his art should he not survive the concentration camps. Eva's Promise is being distributed on PBS stations in the spring of 2024 by American Public Television. McCarthy teaches documentary film and journalism at Montclair State University. Steve and I met when he was the producer of a piece for the Today Show about Jonathan Alter's dealing with cancer and deciding to join me in doing the 192-mile Pan-Mass Challenge Bikeathon for the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. We have been friends since then and decided to create a TV show based on the Who Says I Can't concept, which we filmed 3 full episodes of and tried to sell to the major networks. They did not exactly bite, and those 3 episodes live on YouTube. And here's Steve McCarthy. How you doing, Steve?
Good. Thanks for having me, Jothy.
I just saw the little teddy bear. Does that mean something?
It does. It's a Grateful Dead hat.
Oh, my gosh.
That's not in my bio, is that I'm also an avid Deadhead. Yes, it's true. That's not in my professional bio, though, but I am. I saw Jerry and the gang, and I mean, I didn't see him 300 times or something like that, but I did go up and down the East Seaboard when I was in college and saw them. So, still see them with John Mayer sometimes and things like that and listen to the music. So, and just actually saw a Dead cover band the other night and with my son and remarked about how cool the crowd is. You know, you'll never see a fight at a Dead show. Everybody's just into peace and love. So
that's great. The thing I've noticed about concerts in the last, I don't know, 5 years maybe. We don't go to a lot, but we'll go to one at, someplace pretty big around here, like even, where the Celtics play, and which is back to being called Boston Garden. And it doesn't matter who's playing. We went to see Billy Joel, and everybody stands nowadays.
Oh, yeah.
They stood for the whole show.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, what if you don't want to stand? You're screwed.
Or what if you're Kathleen's size, my wife? You know, we went to a Springsteen concert once. And, you know, she didn't see much.
All right. So one of the questions I wanted to ask you is that you've had, as your bio says, you've had McCarthy Productions since 2001.
Right.
And so that's... It's sort of a family business. Would you agree it's sort of a family business?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, my key employee, of course, or my key partner really is my son, Ryan, who's my editor. and he's my rock, and he's the opposite of me in many ways, in that he's very calm and meticulous and kind. So I partner with him. But also my son Justin has filmed with me. He was on camera for the Eva's Promise, which is our latest endeavor, which is premiering on PBS next month. And Allison did the graphics for that. She was also, Allison and Justin shot most of the HBO film, Breslin Hamill, Deadline Artist, and Ryan did some shooting as well as media management. And even my daughter, Madeline, worked on the Breslin Hamill piece. So all four of the kids worked on that one. And it really is one of the great joys of my life that I was able to bring my children along with me on some of these crazy voyages that I've had. You know, Ryan went to Turkey with me when we did the Prime Minister of Turkey, Erdogan, with Charlie Rose. Justin came down to Peru when I was doing a Vandersloot. We went to the prison that Vandersloot was in, the criminal from the Aruba murder, Natalie Holloway murder. Allison went on a nationwide tour with me shooting a commercial, been on a lot of commercial shoots with me. So it's been really terrific showing them what I did for all these years, what I do, how I travel. And then, of course, with Eva's Promise, it was critical to the production because we didn't have any money. So I had to kind of ask the boys to come to London with me. And then Justin went on to Amsterdam with me. And they got paid, but not what they should have got paid. But we were able to do this great film about an unbelievable Holocaust story that's related to Anne Frank. And now it's going to be on PBS and hopefully live forever as an education tool about the Holocaust, which I think is needed more than ever right now, as we know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So it's a family business, but it's a small business. And, you know, and you just sort of alluded to the fact that, yeah, you know, it's had some ups and downs. I mean, you haven't ever come close to like having to shut it down or anything, but.
No. What I've done though, is I've done some things I didn't want to do. So, you know, some pieces, some stories. I made a lot of money in advertising, and, you know, as a journalist, that's usually like, oh my God, you're doing corporate videos. Yes, I've done corporate videos. You're damn straight I have. You know, I come from a blue collar background where work is work. I'd love to be able to stand on my journalism soapbox and say that it's, you know, you can't do both and everything, but A, you can nowadays. And B, again, work is work. I approach this as labor, as I'm getting paid to do this. I recently had somebody try to get me onto a project and everything, and then was shocked when I gave them the estimate of the bill, even though I was giving them like 25% off. And I'm like, okay, this isn't a hobby for me. You know, this is how I make my living. This is my work. I approach it like that, seriously and meticulously and carefully and everything else. Now, I do have a very strong place in my heart for journalism. And I'm actually talking to somebody now in one of the journalism major companies about maybe doing some work on some shorter stories for them right now. And I always have that because I believe that journalism is key to a democracy, is key to our society. Right now, I'm teaching young journalists. I just got back from a trip to Arizona with 16 young journalists from Montclair State University. And we went to the border and we actually saw something extraordinary happen. We drove along the border for about 10 miles up and down. This is the Trump wall, you know. We got to this migrant camp and there was 120 people there from all over the world. They were from Nepal, they were from Guinea, they were from Ecuador, literally all over the world. And we start interviewing this guy from Ecuador. Ecuador is having some really big problems right now. And a lot of people are fleeing. And all of a sudden we hear people start running, the border patrol, the border patrol. But they don't run away from them. They run to them and line up to be processed. This is the Biden policy. We watched it happen before our eyes. You just have to step foot in this country and say, I want asylum, and you're in. So, you know, this is an interesting debate. It's an election year right now. It's a volatile issue. There are two sides to this story. There's one of a country that has a history of asylum that welcomes people in who are in trouble. There's another side that, hey, there's no systematic way to do this right now. And people are streaming across the border. We're never going to keep track of them. And, you know, I think they're here to work. I think they're here to make their lives better. I think they're mostly decent people. I feel that some of the opposition to it is tinged in racism, maybe. But those are my opinions. But for my students, it was all journalism. I'm like, we went to Arizona and covered that story, as well as the water issue, as well as the homeless issue, as well as we went up to the Grand Canyon. We went to a cowboy ranch and had some guy learn how to ride a horse. We did all these stories. So it's very passionate for me. It's one of my passions, journalism. And I'm thrilled to be able to bring it to young people, particularly the young people in New Jersey, the working class, the sons and daughters of the working class in New Jersey who go to Montclair State. It's the same kid I was when I went to SUNY Oswego. My dad was a cop in Brooklyn. So like I'm, you know, journalism is the core of it. And it's the core of McCarthy Productions too.
Really. Mm-hmm. So some slightly related question. So many years ago, you and I created this thing, which we called Can Do Productions.
Right.
And I reached out to friends and family to get us some funding. And so we set off and we had a lot of fun. I think I certainly did. We created these three episodes. We had Maureen, the sailor. We had Kelly, the triathlete, and Hugh Herr, the rock climber. Each of them had a significant physical disability, and each of them is a superstar. You taught me how to do the 60-minute style of interview. I'd never realized before that it makes it so easy to edit, because if the person talking is, you have the back of their head and you edit something out, you don't see that. So yes, it's great.
Storytelling, you know, that's really what that was. And that's what I love to do, is tell good stories. And you were great. You were a natural at it. You really were. You just got it.
We had, what was great to me was that, yeah, we talked to the person and we asked them to tell their story. And most of these people, it's been long enough that they're able to tell it. And you almost have to, after a while, you have to tell it in a somewhat unemotional way. Right. But when you ask family members, like we asked Kelly Bruno's mother to speak, and we got, we didn't always get family members, but it was great when we did. And sometimes they were even more emotional about it. But then we did the second day, and I'm certain it was your idea when we were first thinking about this, where you said, well, you know, you're Mr. Who Says I Can't. And so what you're going to have to do on the second day is you have to participate in their sport and just do it and say, who says I can't? And so, which was really the secret to this thing, I think, coming out pretty good. So, you know, I took on Maureen in sailing.
Yeah.
Maureen was the first American to win a gold medal in sailing in the Paralympics.
Yeah, she's awesome.
What was amazing was watching you and so you had, it wasn't your son, it was another person who had the other camera.
Well, maybe Bruce or Steve were working with me at that time. Yeah, that was before my kids got of age, really. I got my friends to work with me, which was another wonderful part of going out on my own. So that I was able to travel the world with these two guys that were my best friends. And so, you know, it's been a great ride. And then to get to meet you on that story with Jonathan, and then to develop this show, which I still think is a great concept and everything. And someday maybe the reality TV stuff will not be about making fun of people and voting people off the island and ridiculing people, and be more about some good stuff like, how did this happen to you and what have you done about it and things like that. Those are good stories, and I still think that concept is a living, breathing thing that should go. You're the perfect host for it because of your personal experience and your your refusal to lie down and take it and to stand up and get involved in these great sports that you're involved in. So like that was really, I loved doing that show. We had a lot of fun. I almost got hit by a prosthetic leg off of a cliff. Narrowly escaped serious injury there. It was really fun.
Every time I've been with you filming, starting with during the time with Jonathan Alter and you know, you were going to track him and me riding, and you guys got into a car and you're hanging out the window on the passenger side with the bikers just in front of you. And Bruce, I think, was the maniacal driver, and he would swerve over if a car was coming right at you, ready for a head-on collision. And you're trying to hold on to your $10,000 camera and not hit bikers. I mean, it was just insane.
Yeah, we take some risks, you know, we try to be careful, but so we got to get the shot, right? You know, and this is kind of what I teach my students too, is that, you know, because sometimes they come in with excuses. Well, I couldn't do this, I couldn't do that. It was like, well, your boss is not going to care about that. You didn't get that shot. We need that. You need that shot. Now, don't risk your life, obviously. Don't risk any hurting anybody else. But sometimes you got to get out there in the world and take some chances to bring this stuff home. So, that was a good part of my life, too. I was doing a bunch of Today Show spots with Jonathan and Mike Barnicle, a Boston guy. And many of the spots were about returning veterans that were coming home, many of them with prosthetics and things like that. And some of them were investigations of the Veterans Administration, and some of them were just political pieces as well. But that Jonathan's piece was part of that. And John is still to this day one of my good friends and neighbors. He lives around the corner. We did the Breslin Hamel film together, and we're doing a couple of other projects together. But some of our work that we did, including your story, was some of our proudest work, you know, that we did to highlight things like cancer and veterans issues and things like that. So, it led to a friendship with you and I too, which I think you and me, which was great. Because I just attended your 50th anniversary of beating cancer. Which when I tell people that, they're like, 50 years, what, he's been cancer-free for 50 years. And that was a terrific party and an amazing, amazing night, to just be with your family and your friends for that. So this is the good part of the business, right? You know, making relationships. I can tell you, Jothi, that there's probably only a half a dozen people that I stay in touch with regularly like you that I've done. And I've done probably 600 stories, you know, anywhere from 2 minutes to 2 hours. So it's very rare that you, because you can't stay in touch with everybody, you know, that's right. 1,000 people that I've done stories on, let alone 3,000 that I've met. But there's a couple of others. Eddie Wright is another guy who's a Marine who lost his hands in Fallujah, but because he was holding a squad automatic weapon, a heavy machine gun that got hit by a RPG. He's a buddy of mine. We stay in touch. Just went out in Dallas, did a pub crawl in Dallas together. Vina Dredden, who's the wife of a widow of a fireman who died in 1994 in a Watts Street fire. I still stay in touch with her. Craig Monahan from Ladder 5 and one of my 9/11 survivors, one of my friends. There's a couple of other people, but it's rare that it happens. And in some ways, it's kind of sad because I've met some great people through the years, but you just can't keep in touch with everybody.
I know. And I try hard too, to keep in touch, and it is,
life is busy.
Yeah. So, you started to mention, you know, trying to find a home for this, show. And, you know, we talked to ESPN, but it was like before ESPN was doing much besides just their normal, sort of live sports shows. Right. They weren't doing much in the way of any kind of films or so they thought about it and didn't say yes. Well, we got really close with ABC.
Yeah. Most people's reaction though were like, oh my God, that sounds so great. I would definitely watch that. And then you ask them, do you watch television? They're like, no, I never watch television. So therein lies the problem, right? People that watch these shows want the guy voted off the island. They want the guy being made fun of. They want the ridicule and stuff. And the people that are kind of the smarter, kinder, gentler people, they're reading books, I guess. I don't know, but they're not watching television. So that was our problem. We were just too kind of a show. Too nice.
I'll never forget where one of the criticisms was, well, the show is too earnest. Yeah. And if you're willing to change it so that somebody gets humiliated or whatever. And I'm thinking of, it's not a show I watched, the Biggest Loser, but I heard about it. And the humiliation that those people must have felt, but they did it, I assume, for the money.
People go on television for all kinds of reasons. Yeah, it's true. But, I think that I don't think you and I could do that. I think we're good people that want to do interesting stuff. And
right. Yeah. We would never change it that way. I mean, what would you do with a guy like Hugh? I mean, yeah. There he is. He's lost both legs below the knee from frostbite. He figured out after a long recovery that he could make these special feet that are only like that big, but they could stand on something that's the thickness of a quarter. Right. And then, we watch him climb. What?
It's like a hoof. He made himself a hoof for like a mountain goat, and it's amazing to watch him do that. He's an incredible guy. He is an incredible guy.
And he took us to this place, in the Catskills called, High Exposure.
Yeah. It's in the Gunks. Isn't it called the Gunks too?
Oh yeah. You're right. It's Gunks. Near the Catskills.
Yeah, yeah.
And this thing is 200-foot vertical. And yeah, you mentioned the part of the story. Well, he said to me later that in all the times he's climbed in all the places, and we know that all prosthetics are held on with suction, and there's a little release valve, release button, which I always tell the people in TSA, do not touch that.
Do not press that button.
But something happened and it pressed and down it goes. And normally climbers are taught to just, really fast yell out rock, but he yells out leg. And you were filming like this straight up.
Yeah.
And then you ran. And saved around. Your camera,
right? Yeah,
and your face.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, no, he was a great character, an interesting character. That's the thing about those three characters; all of them were interesting and different, and that's why that's the concept of that show. I still think can work. I just think we need to find a kinder, gentler place to put it, and maybe we can let's check it out again. Let's sell it again. Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. Well, so. So one of the things I talk about in my book and on this podcast and whenever I'm talking to people about their startups is a term that I don't think is used that much in other disciplines, and it's called product market fit. And we didn't have product market fit. We had a great product, in our opinion, and the market at the time wasn't accepting it for the reasons we've said.
Yeah,
I do feel like we got pretty close with Mr. ABC.
Yeah, yeah. You never know, though. I mean, this is what we do. Create content is extremely difficult, and I run into this all the time. That especially like I had, for instance, I had a film on HBO. We won an Emmy for it. It was very successful. So I got all kinds of phone calls. Hey, I got an idea for a movie. I'm like, okay, great. Find $1 million and come back and tell me. You think this is easy to do? It's extremely hard to do. Any of it is really hard to do, the independent stuff. I have like 5 independent films now that I have owned part of. And 40 years of working here doing this stuff like that. So it's really, really tough. The latest one, the Holocaust story, again, after HBO, somebody came to me and said, I have this film. And I'm like, oh, great. Then she said, it's about a Holocaust survivor. So I'm like, well, that's the last chance I'll ever get to do anything with a Holocaust survivor. They're dying off, right? And then she said the magic words, there's some limited funding. So bing, off we go. Now, she was 92 years old. Her name is Eva Schloss. And we got, Ryan and Justin and I got on a plane, is, you know, within 2 or 3 months, and went over there and recorded 12 hours of her story. And I thought we were going for a 20 to 25 minute educational film. When I got home, then we went to Amsterdam and filmed there too. I realized I had a 57 minute PBS hour. I knew it in my bones I had it, because I'd done that before. We had another thing on PBS. But it was not easy to do that after that. So it wasn't finished. And what we needed to get a cut done to show her, the woman, and the story in a nutshell is the family flees Vienna after the Anschluss, moves to Amsterdam, across the street from the Frank family. She's Anne Frank's age. Her older brother, Heinz, is Margot's. Her older brother, Heinz, is a musician, an incredibly talented musician, a human jukebox. They're okay for a while. The Nazis invade Netherlands. They start turning the screws on. They go into hiding. Heinz can't practice his music, so he begins to do paintings and poetry, deep stuff. They're hiding separately. They get betrayed. They're on a train to Auschwitz. He tells her he's hid the poetry and the paintings in the attic. Promise me you'll get them if I don't make it. And that's Eva's promise. So we bring this movie to London to show her. We go back to Amsterdam. The Anne Frank House puts on a screening for us. All the time we're raising money. We're actually on the synagogue circuit, if you will. We're playing in synagogues and some small theaters in New England and places like that, just raising $1,000 here, $500 there, to then hire my friend Jacob, a musician, to do some incredible theme work, and to hire Ryan to pay him to edit it. And basically, we somehow get this thing in a shape where American Public Television, based in Boston, watches it and says, we want this. And they went and they shopped it to almost 20 PBS stations. And now it's coming on. But that road, you know, that 2.5 years of me not making a dime, by the way, but whatever, that's the difficult of the independent producer. It is really, really hard to do. And so my advice to anybody trying to get into it is just know that. I don't want to squash any dreams or anything, but know that it's really hard to do. Know that you have to be super resourceful. Know that you have to do everything sometimes. You know, I shot it, I wrote it, I directed it, I lit it. You just have to wear multiple hats. But I'll tell you that I feel really great about it now, because particularly about what's happening in the world and the rise of anti-Semitism that occurred just as we were making it started. And the fact that, you know, we can't forget that this thing happened, and we need to remind people through the ages. So this film will live as an educational tool. It will also live in a raw form. We're going to probably donate the raw stuff to Shoah. So, again, it's a great story. And that's really what I hope my tombstone reads. He told good stories, you know, that's, I taught some kids. That's all I'd be happy with that.
What? Why, if the two of them both were on the train to Auschwitz, why, how did she survive and not him?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think, you know, Holocaust survivors ask that question every day of their lives, I guess, after that. But she had some luck happen in that she was given the job of sorting through the clothes of people who were being basically murdered. And then she could find food and things. Then her mother was actually about to be selected. Mengele was the doctor there. When somehow her cousin worked in the, was a nurse that worked for Mengele in the ward and got her. So how did people survive? You know, I mean, there's millions of Holocaust stories. And sometimes it was just sheer luck. Sometimes it was fortitude. In this case, it was because they're, you know, her cousin, her mother's cousin, worked for Dr. Mengele in the hospital ward, somehow got her in there. Heinz, he almost survived, because after the camp was freed, she walked over to the men's part looking for them, and she ran into Otto Frank. And Otto Frank was still alive. How did he survive? I don't know, but he did. And he said that the boys have left, her father and brother, and they went on a march with the Nazis. At that time, sort of at the end of World War II and stuff, there was a lot of weird stuff that happened. Like there was inexplicable stuff. For instance, the Frank girls, Anne Frank, they were marched to another concentration camp and died there. Why? No one really knows why. So the Germans obviously were in the throes of realizing that they're going to not only lose, but probably be prosecuted. So some weird stuff happened. So we don't know how Heinz got killed. We think he was murdered while he was trying to hide weapons in Austria in the mountains. But we really don't know that. Eva, you know, again, was 15 when she entered and spent a little bit less than a year there, but got typhus and got sick and some horrible things happened to her. You know, how does she live to 94 too? You know, that's, it's mind-boggling to me. But she's something else, and she's an amazing woman, and has really made her, you know, she didn't talk about the Holocaust for 40 years. Wow. Meanwhile, her mother married Otto Frank and grew up in the shadow of the Diary of Anne Frank and couldn't talk about it. And then when she started to in the 90s, she was unstoppable. She toured the world talking about it, telling her story. But she never told Heinz's story. She never did. She never did. And she felt kind of like, you know, Anne Frank got all the press, man, you know, and Heinz got forgotten. Meanwhile, what Heinz did was beautiful. The poetry is very deep that he wrote.
It's incredible. So where is that? Where is all of that stuff, the artwork and the poetry? It's
the Museum of Resistance in Amsterdam, where we filmed. And they have a child wing, actually, where they feature four children, one of them a Nazi, one of them a resistance child, one a bystander, they call them. They didn't get involved in anything. And then Eva is a Jewish kid in there. So that's all there. They hold all her material. They hold Heinz's paintings. They hold his poetry. And we were able to go there and film it with them and talk to the director and stuff. So it's a great story, and it fits nicely into a PBS hour. There's no commercial interruptions. You know, it's just straight on storytelling for an hour. Mm. And she pretty much is the backbone of the story. We have 12 hours of interview of her with two cameras and 4K. And she just delivers. And speaking about being dispassionate, I did stop the interview at one point and said, well, how can you talk about this and not have any emotion? And she said, I've told this story so many times, you know, because she goes around to groups, that it feels like I'm almost talking about somebody else. So it was amazing to me that she could do that, that emotion. She got emotional a couple of times, but it's an amazing story. She's an amazing woman. It's something I hope that many, many children look at, because it involves young people and the Holocaust and how they survived. And I got to tell you, it was kind of odd making this, because I was making it really during COVID, right? And I was hearing about young people complaining that they were, you know, stuck in their house and playing, had to play video games and everything else. And I kept thinking about Eva, you know, hiding from the Nazis who were going to kill you. Not to put down those kids there was a lot of stuff from the COVID thing that we're dealing with now that's still bad and everything. But, you know, think it can always be worse, right? It can be worse. Like Nazis want to kill you, you know, so I think that this film is going to last for a long time. And I think it's going to go to a lot of schools, and it's not too graphic. So I think even middle schoolers can watch it and understand it and see how teenagers dealt with, you know, being persecuted and with hate and with people betraying them and turning them in and everything. And, you know, I think that society is fragile. To think that that couldn't happen again is ridiculous. You know, we saw a little bit during COVID of society around fraying around the edges, and it could happen. I don't want to be a doomsday guy, but you know, we're just holding on to some things in this world right now, and so I think people need to realize that we need to keep it. We need to love one another. We need not to hate. We need not to support haters, and we need to stand up and say that this is wrong when we feel that it's wrong.
Mm-hmm. You've been to the Holocaust Museum in D.C., right?
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing, I was talking to a friend about it just yesterday, in fact, that You know, I probably am up for it maybe once every 10 years. It's not a place you could go. Right. And maybe especially for, so there's a, I have a personal connection to it. My half of my father's family was from a town, the town of Vilna. And if you remember, there's a tower of photographs in the middle of the museum that you, and the stairs go around it. So those are people that were my family. And I can tell because my father looks exactly like some of them.
Wow.
So, and it's, it, you know, I remember walking into that museum and nobody speaks in there. Yeah. You just, you go through it and you go slowly and you come out 2 hours later and you haven't said a word and you can't believe it's been 2 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's an amazing time in humanity. And, it's hard to believe that it actually even happened. You know, I've been engrossed in it now for the last 2.5 years. And it's just, when I see it sometimes too, when I even watch my own film, there is an anger that boils up sometimes that this happened, that people treated other people this way. But again, you know, the hate is, hate sells, baby. Hate sells, you know, it sells today.
Well, we certainly see that.
Yeah.
You mentioned, we started off talking about, you know, the family business aspects and I learned a lot from you about, you know, how to be on camera and how to do those kind of interviews. One of the things that I had no idea about, cause you, at least, you know, just you see sort of a little once in a while, you see what maybe goes into some of these interviews and whatnot. But the thing you don't realize is what a job it is to edit some of these things. And you talk about how many hours of 4K film you have. Watching your son Ryan, and he has this, you know, Final Cut Pro, and it's like, and he goes backwards and forwards, and then he'll have something, he'll say, okay, let's review it. And you'll review it and say, oh no, that needs to be moved and that needs to be shorter. And he goes, whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. And he's got something ready to show with that change made in like 30 seconds. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And how he can go through all that footage and find the good stuff and find, separate it out. It's amazing.
Yeah, well, there's a process, and it involves me writing a script for him to start with, which helps him a lot. But the editor that we used for the Breslin Hamill thing on HBO, he did a different process. He didn't want his name is Jeff Bartz. He didn't want my script. He's like, that's not how I work. He looked at everything, every single thing, and started to fashion like almost like an old-fashioned shoemaker or glove maker, this finely crafted film, right? So there are different ways of doing it. Ryan and I have a great working relationship in that I basically get everything transcribed and sort of work on paper and words first. And then he assembles it. And then the pictures come in, you know, that he crafts and stuff that he knows that I got for him out in the field. But it's a creative process that is very, lengthy and sometimes can be extremely annoying. And I had a partner on this last one, Susan Kerner, who was never involved in a film before in her life. She's a theater director, but she was a natural about this. She was great. She knew the story. She had, directed a play about Eva Schloss, so she knew the story well. But she was great. And you were a great partner, too, because you had some innate storytelling ability in you that just came out. I don't know whether it was from your family or your life experience or whatever, but you were a natural storyteller and you were very comfortable interviewing people, which is huge because you put people at ease and you had a conversation with them. And what we got was great stuff because of that.
Yeah, process was good.
Very fun. Yeah.
It was good. And I did learn from you about that, writing the script first. And in fact, I use that same technique. If I'm going to do a talk, before I get a single image or anything, or even in my, company, if I'm going to try to do a story to, a pitch to investors, I write every word I'm going to say first. And then I put the images together, and then I take the story and distill it down to just a few bullets. So I'm not reading when I'm presenting, and I see the reminder, oh, don't forget to say this. And it works. It's great. And I actually talk about that in when I'm trying to recommend to people in my book how to go do their pitch deck. I say the exact same thing.
Yeah, it's about preparation really too, right? There's production's it's a stool with three legs, and there's pre-production, production, and post-production. If any one of them is weak, thing falls down. And that's what we teach up at Montclair State too. When we went to Phoenix this last week, though, they had spent 6 or 8 weeks researching all their stories. They were prepared, and they found some better stuff when they got there too, which will happen. And I'm sure that sometimes in your middle of your speech, something will come to you and you'll add on to what you've already done. It's a creative process and it's fun. I love it. I hope it never stops. I hope I never stop doing it. What about you? We're almost the same age. Are you thinking about retiring at all?
I have set a specific date. I have set a specific date. It's 2 years from this summer. I'm going to stop working, full time. But part of the reason I'm doing these podcasts and some speaking, and I love writing, is that those are the three things that I'll carry on with, right, and have even more fun with. Right. But and it's nice to start now doing some of these things so that, I've built up expertise at it, hopefully, and also maybe there'll be a following that I can build on as I retire. Well, listen, I think we've covered everything I wanted to cover. This has been really fun. It always is talking to you and having you explain all that stuff, I think will be great. People are going to love that. That's going to be a wrap for today. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Adventures on the Can Do. Please share and like us on your social media channels. This is Jothi Rosenberg, and I'll be back with a new episode every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. Don't forget to check out the show notes for additional resources and links. Hasta la vista.